Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Adam Mueller, and I represent Dan Agakian, who traveled from Florida to be with us today. My attorney registration number is 42176. In the limited time I have today, I plan to focus on the speedy trial issue, but I'm happy to answer any questions this court has on the other issues raised in the briefs. Under Colorado law, a continuance caused by docket congestion is chargeable to the court and not to the defense. The only exception to this rule is when the district court makes a reasonable effort to account for its congested docket and the case is nevertheless continued beyond speedy trial and defense counsel was unavailable. And that's the Supreme Court's decision in Hills versus Westminster Municipal Court. Now, before this court and in this case, the Attorney General argues that the district court acted reasonably because it offered a single date within the speedy trial period, but defense counsel was unable to accept it. So in essence, the Attorney General is asking this court's rule as a matter of law that a court acts reasonably when it offers a single date within the speedy trial period. But that's not what the Supreme Court held in Hills. And we know this because that was the position the Court of Appeals Division in Hills took. On page 1225 of the Court of Appeals opinion, the majority wrote, where there is a continuance before the expiration of speedy trial, the court offers a new date within speedy trial, the defendant rejects the date, and because of defendant's rejection of the date, the court then sets the case beyond speedy, the delay is attributable to the defendant. That's a categorical, bright-line rule that makes really no account for different circumstances. But that rule was not adopted by the Supreme Court in Hills. Instead, what Hills ruled was that the district court has to make a reasonable attempt to accommodate for its docket congestion, and only then will defense counsel's unavailability be the cause of the delay.
Counsel, did the Hills court, or has any other court in Colorado, specifically outlined the parameters of reasonable effort? I mean, I always thought reasonableness required sort of a case-by-case inquiry.
Hills is the first case, to my knowledge. He cited Hills and didn't find anything discussing it since then. So Hills talks about reasonableness and concludes that what was reasonable in that case, I would contrast what happened in this case, but I'm aware of no other case in the state which talks about the parameters of Hills. But my position is that Hills is really on one end of the spectrum, and this case is quite on the other. Because in this case, as opposed to in Hills, defense counsel had had a lot of availability, whereas the district court had limited availability. In Hills, the district court had a lot of availability. Hills, the district court offered 5 separate dates within speedy trial, and defense counsel rejected them all. And then defense counsel proposed 2 dates outside of speedy trial. In this case, defense counsel accepted 2 dates within speedy trial, proposed a 3rd within speedy trial, but the court was on vacation and couldn't take it, and was only unable to accept 1 date, and that was the May 1st date, the very last date. But the defense counsel's inability to accept that date shouldn't be chargeable to the defendant in this case, given what the district court did and in fact didn't do. And so I would take you back really to December 2nd in this case. In December 2nd, 2011, the district court, that was the trial, said, offered 2 dates to counsel. And the court said, we have only 2 dates available before speedy expires. Those dates are March 27th and April 24th. The court expressed a preference for the March date, saying if we pick April and something happens, we don't have any more dates before speedy. That's why I want to take the March date. Defense counsel had a different, defense counsel had responsibilities, professional responsibilities. He moved them around, accepted the March date. Of course, it was continued due to docket congestion on that day, and we went to April 27th. In the meantime, or April 24th. In the meantime, defense counsel had proposed August 16th, but the court, as I said, was on vacation. Come August 24th or 24th, the district court once again said, we have to continue the case due to docket congestion. I've got 1 more day left, May 1st. But never before had the district court told defense counsel or the parties or anyone that that was an available date. In fact, all the way back in December, the trial court had said, that's not available. We have 2 and only 2 dates. So it could not have come as a surprise to the district court that defense counsel was unavailable on May 1st.
Well, counsel, let me ask you this. If we're looking at a reasonable effort by the trial court, we have a trial court who has set it initially on April 24th or May 27th and, or March 27th.
Yeah, I apologize.
Okay, no problem. And then April 24th. All right. So there were two dates. And then due to no fault of anyone, really, there was docket congestion. It would be attributable to the court because of docket congestion. But the court had made an effort twice to set it within speedy. And when there was docket congestion, it made a third effort to set it within speedy. So how is that not reasonable?
Okay. The two reasons, Your Honor. The first is that if defense counsel had been aware back in December, when the original trial setting was selected, that these were all the dates we have available going forward, trial dates, and then defense counsel came in on April 24th and said, actually, I'm not available on May 1st, that would be reasonable by the district court, because defense counsel would have had 6 months' notice, approximately, that that's a date you need to be prepared and able to go. But defense counsel was never told that. The district court said, we only have two and only 2 days. So that's the first reason. The second reason is that the reason defense counsel was unavailable on May 1st wasn't because he was on vacation, as was the case in Wilson, for example, but because he had all these other commitments that he had rearranged to accommodate the first two trial dates. And that's the other key component in your case, that the unavailability of defense counsel on May 1st was largely occasioned and predictably the result of the docket congestion continuances earlier on. And defense counsel made a record on this from the very beginning. He said, Your Honor, I have a trial in another client's case, Mr. Soto. I had to move that once to a one date. He had to continue another trial from that date. He had to move motions hearings, preliminary hearings, and he made this record all along. So as I said, it could not have come as a surprise to the district court that defense counsel was unavailable, because the district court's earlier continuances largely occasioned that unavailability. And so for those two primary reasons, defense counsel's unavailability is not the cause, and the district court's actions here were unreasonable. And I'd actually mention one other thing that doesn't bear directly on the speedy trial issue in the sense that it didn't cause the delay, but it shows kind of the reasonableness of the district court's actions here compared with what defense counsel did. And that's the mental condition, the request for a ruling on what it means to cooperate. Defense counsel filed that motion all the way back at the time of arraignment, many months before, nearly a year before trial actually occurred. And the district court declined to rule on the motion until what would have been the first day of trial. And so that does not bear directly on the speedy trial issue. As I said, it doesn't result in the continuance, but it shows how defense counsel, I think, pretty perceptively recognize the problems that could arise in this case, given the complexities of the mental condition issue and the docket congestion which he had been informed by the court. Whereas the court, on the other hand, really didn't adequately plan and account for its congested docket, or even rule in a timely fashion on a motion that was central to the case. So I've talked a little bit about Hills and a little bit about the district court's, the defense counsel's foresight, really, in filing that motion for the definition of cooperation. And the final aspect of this, I would say, on Hills is that when Hills was continued the last time, there was still 1 month left in the speedy trial period. And so it's reasonable, I think, in that case, to expect an attorney to find some trial availability within that month for a municipal court trial. Presumably that trial wasn't very long. When the trial was continued in this case, the very last time, on April 24th, there were only 10 days left in the speedy trial period, and it was a 6-day trial. And so it's not reasonable to expect defense counsel to have that availability when he's already pre-cleared 2 weeks to make himself available, and he never had any notice in advance that he needed to be available on May 1st.
So are you suggesting that a reasonable effort is equivalent with a court having a belief that it would be reasonable that counsel would be available? Is that the same test is what you're arguing?
My point is merely that if, when the district court has given defense counsel no notice that we're up on the edge of speedy and there isn't another date available, if there is, you know, a month or so, the district court might be reasonable. The district court might be off the hook, to use kind of a colloquial expression, for having not maybe prepared as well in advance. There's a lot of time to recover from that, to account for it when there's still a month left in the speedy trial period. When there's 10 days left, and it's a 6-day trial, and defense counsel has already continued multiple other cases and has made this record all along of the position he was being put in, then it was not reasonable for the district court to expect defense counsel in this case to be available for one other date when he was never told that that was the date he needed to be available. If the court doesn't have any other questions at this point, I would reserve my time, but I'm happy to answer any other questions.
All right, you've got a little less than 5 minutes remaining for rebuttal.
May it please the court, my name is Jay Fisher. I represent the people in this matter, registration number 44350. Your honors, the trial court acted reasonably under the specific facts and circumstances of this case. It tried to balance and juggle a number of competing interests, and based upon the defendant's representations that it couldn't accept the alternative that the court had provided, the delay was appropriately charged to the defendant, and his speedy trial rights under the statute were not violated. The statutory speedy trial rule is not a wooden or mechanical rule. It's not applied in such a fashion. The intent of it is to prevent delay on the trial court's part, on the prosecution's part. Really, the case law says that the ultimate goal here is that a just result is intended. When this court is assessing how the trial court acted in this particular fashion, the only variable it has to assess is the reasonableness of the trial court's efforts to try and schedule a matter within the speedy trial deadline. The defendant's efforts to accommodate trial court's efforts really do not factor into this particular analysis.
How do you figure? How's that figure in? You know, when you say kind of like defendant's efforts don't factor into the analysis, how can a defendant, how can a trial court's efforts be considered reasonable when every other time, let's put it a different way. Defense counsel has been trying to accommodate and trying to find dates in which the trial court is open, but every time the trial court comes up and says, docket congestion, priorities. How is it reasonable to eventually, 10 days before the end of the expiration of the speedy trial period, to give you one day that you had no notice of? How is that reasonable?
Well, it's reasonable, first of all, under the reading of Hills. The Hills court basically said that the only factor that goes into this is assessing what the trial court did. Not what the defendant did, but what the trial court did.
So it didn't matter in Hills that the defense counsel there rejected 5 dates that were made available to him or her. Didn't matter?
Ultimately, it was a focus on what the trial court did to try to accommodate all the competing interests as well as the defendant's interests in that matter. Yes, that's what Hills says.
And so there were 5 available dates in that case. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Well, in this case, the trial court offered 3 or 4 dates, but then the trial court essentially withdrew those dates. Is that correct?
That would be correct. But again, what Hills stands for and what all the cases assessing speedy trial deadlines stand for is an examination of what the trial court did on an ad hoc basis. So in other words, you look specifically for what the variables that the trial court was facing. Not what maybe the Hills court did, not what the courtroom next door did. It's what the variables occurred in that specific trial that the court is reviewing, that the appellate court is reviewing. So really, any other comparisons, any other cases are not appropriate, at least under the standards that have been articulated regarding speedy trial deadlines and accommodating it. I think there's 2 aspects to reasonableness that need to be looked at regarding the trial court. First of all, there's the aspect of the trial court's reading of the situation before it and whether that was reasonable and whether it developed a reasonable alternative based upon the facts before it. Going to the first aspect of the reasonableness, the trial court basically told the defendant on 2 occasions it had a case that had priority. It involved a child sex assault victim, and at least according to the read of statute section 18.3411 subsection 4, the trial court had to take that matter before it took the defendant's case. So again, it would be the people's position that trial court acted reasonably under the plain letter of that particular statute. That statute says twice, shall. In other words, the trial court shall take this matter before any other matters. That being the word of command, again, the trial court acted reasonably. There's a second aspect here, which is the court was trying to respect the parties' various interests and schedules. Counsel for the defendants already said, the counsel had a number of matters that it had to address, being a solo practitioner. Counsel said that he had a number of motions and client meetings that he had to take, and consequently, the trial court was reasonable in trying to accommodate those interests as well.
Counsel, can the trial court act reasonably in the greater sense, as far as GF got lots of priorities, and unreasonably in a more focused sense? And that is, gee, we're talking about a particular individual's right to a speedy trial. Can you act reasonably in a greater sense and still act, not make reasonable efforts when it comes to compliance with the speedy trial statute?
I'm sure I could come up with a scenario where that's the case, but I don't think that's the case here, because I think it also goes to the third variable, which is the efforts the trial court made to try to find a courtroom that was available to accommodate the defendant's case. I think if the court had made just a minimal inquiry of one or two judges to say, does anyone have time, and then that was it, I think that would probably be unreasonable. But the judge in this case said that he approached all the judges in his courthouse, in his district, said who has time, found the one judge who had time, and then presented, or at least blocked off or reserved that time for the defendant and the prosecutor in this particular case to try and schedule the matter. So it made every reasonable effort to try and respect the defendant's speedy trial right.
Well, counsel, let me ask you this, because in the Arledge case, it was giving an example of where the court could have asked senior judges to hear a case, not just the sitting judges, and that would have demonstrated a reasonable effort. And so that did not happen here?
To the best of my read of the record, no, it didn't happen. Then the final, or let's say the second part of the reasonable analysis is whether the trial court, in fact, developed a reasonable alternative for the defendant's particular matter. Again, estimating whether the parties could have performed this trial within 3 days is basically engaging in a judicial guessing game. The parties originally asserted that it would be a 4-day trial, and the defendant was originally presented with the alternative of a 3-day trial. He initially said, I don't think we can do it. Then he said, I know we can't do it. However, I think the court needs to be aware that at a hearing on May 25th, comes into court and endorses 4 additional witnesses for any trial, and then says, yeah, I think we can probably do this in 3 days. So again, we're sort of engaging in a guessing game of whether this trial could have been performed within the timeline. It all goes to the reasonable assessment of how did the trial court's efforts in this matter. Again, 3 days from the people's read was, in fact, a reasonable alternative. I know the defendant has made an issue regarding the trial court's ruling on cooperation and whether that should, in fact, factor into this, or at least what the defendant assessed as a dilatory effort on the trial court's part. There's an aspect here that this court needs to be aware of when assessing this particular matter, and that is basically the release date of the Bondurant decision and its influence upon this. Again, the court originally said that it could not find that the defendant had not cooperated with the exam. So, in essence, it said, yeah, he cooperated. However, Bondurant comes out again on March 29, 2012, and the prosecution moved on April 12, 2012, just a couple weeks before the trial date. And then the court is subsequently ruled on April 16th. So the court, in fact, ruled within 4 days of the prosecutor's motion. No one had any control of when Bondurant was going to come out. And Bondurant was directly on point regarding the definition of cooperation and how it should influence the trial court's decision in that matter. So to sit there and say the trial court was dilatory and how it ruled on the issue is not completely accurate.
All right, let me ask you a question going back to the straight speedy trial issue, because I think what I'm struggling with here is kind of a chicken and the egg problem here, is we have a scheduling conflict, undeniable schedule conflict by defense counsel. And I think your opposing counsel is saying, but the court put defense counsel in that position and didn't give defense counsel notice that that would have even been an available week. And so how does that figure into the analysis?
I think the aspect that factors into this is the recognition that this deadline is coming and whether council should have kept his schedule clear to at least the approach of the speedy trial deadline, knowing that this where there was this big hurdle. Again, looking at what council had assessed were issues that it considered, at least for scheduling purposes, superior to a felony jury trial, which were motions hearings and meetings with clients. There has to be some kind of give and take on council's part regarding what is should be at least the more serious matter to be taken and what is something that probably should take priority here.
Well, let's go back a little bit, because the court had told council that the only week I have available is April 24th. And then on April 24th is the first time the court said, well, I can also do May 1st. So I think there was that element of lack of notice. So when you're saying, well, council should have kept schedule clear, I think your opposing counsel is saying, but council didn't have notice to do that. So is that something that we can consider? And just going back to chicken and the egg, did the court put defense counsel in that position of filling up that week because counsel thought the week was available?
I think it's something that can be certainly incorporated into the reasonableness analysis, but it's just one variable of many. And even if this court were to find that the trial court in this matter were somehow deficient regarding the notice it provided to counsel, again, it can't deny that the trial court in this matter certainly provided lots of reasonable effort to accommodate, again, its schedule, counsel's schedule, and also matters that it considered to be superior to the defendant's case under the statutes at stake.
Do you remember the number of cases that say, you know, sometimes litigants can be forced to choose between their rights and their consequences that attach between their choices? Counsel may, or court may have been in a tough situation here, but there's the statutory priority that you mentioned, but there's also defense right to a speedy trial. Should the trial court have to have provided a consequence of its choice and the prosecution?
And do you mean, just for clarification purposes, between the defendant's speedy trial rights and also the scheduling of the other case?
The priority, that's correct.
We're getting into a situation where I'm trying to assess whether the trial court was right for holding the child sex assault case superior to the defendant's case. However, again, assessing this within whether it was a reasonable read of the situation before the court, I think, is a different analysis than whether it was a correct assessment. Because, as I said, the judge was aware of the statute, the judge was aware of the victim in this particular case being a child sex assault victim, and also the situation with the defendant and his meaty trial rate.
Was that case about to be dismissed?
I'm unaware of that, Your Honor, and I did not see that information in the record, whether it was in risk of being dismissed or not. And this court has no further questions. We ask you to affirm the conviction below. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Mueller, you have 4 minutes and 55 seconds.
Thank you. I just have a few points. The Attorney General talked about priority, and that's where the discussion ended, priority of perhaps other cases and the unavailability of other judges. That's just another way of saying docket congestion. The fact that another case maybe took priority doesn't bear on the question, because that just shows the docket was congested. I'm perfectly willing to assume the other case took statutory priority, but that's no excuse under the speedy trial statute. The speedy trial statute requires that my client be brought to trial within 6 months. And if there's too many other cases, then the courts and the prosecution have to figure it out. It's not on defense counsel to account for the priority of other cases.
Can we, before you leave that,
yeah.
Okay, we're at March 27th, you know, and suddenly you've got this case that I understand by statute is supposed to take priority over this case, but no, it did or didn't. What at that point could the judge have done to make a reasonable accommodation here, to act reasonably to bring this case to trial within speedy trial? From that point on, I know what you're saying, they should have ruled earlier on
yeah.
the other stuff, But by March 27th, what were the choices available to him that he didn't take advantage of?
I think the easiest choice was the one Judge Lichtenstein pointed to earlier, perhaps, which is bring in a senior judge.
Okay, bring in a senior.
I've seen that happen where I read the transcript, I'm like, who's this? This is a senior judge who wasn't necessarily the motions hearing judge. So
always risky.
So, but I'm perfectly happy to have a senior judge. But it certainly would have accommodated the speedy trial right.
Okay.
The other thing is, if the defense counsel, the district court knew that May 1st was going to be available, he could have told defense counsel at that point more a month and a half in advance and said, we're going to be busy on April 24th as well. I may have a date on May 1st. So, counsel, I need you to look at your calendar. And that would be more akin to what happened in Hills, because at that point, as I said, the last continuance before the case was set beyond speedy, there was still a month left. So if defense counsel had known on March 27th that there was a chance the case was not going to go on April 24th and that he should be ready on May 1st as well, then, that's a very different case. He's got 6 weeks nearly to see if he can get his schedule cleared. So those were two options the court could have taken. The second point I'd just like to make on Mondragon, it's kind of a side issue. If you look at the transcript on pages, it's one PDF file, if my recollection is correct. So pages 331 to 333 and 340 to 341. Initially, the district court's ruling here was that my client had not cooperated. That ruling never changed. What changed was the district court initially said the cooperation wasn't so bad as for me to throw out your experts. It was kind of trivial non-cooperation, marginal non-cooperation. All along, the court had ruled that my client had not cooperated. And Bondurant doesn't really change that. Bondurant discussed the definition of cooperation. Well, if my client didn't cooperate, Bondurant doesn't really shed much light on the court's ruling on that from the court's perspective, because he'd already ruled that my client didn't cooperate. But I think to get back to the heart of the matter here, docket congestion is a real thing. I mean, that's something we have to accept. But what's required under Hills is the district court to make reasonable accommodations and plan for that. And that didn't happen in this case, because defense counsel and the conduct of defense counsel is relevant. Hills talks a lot about the conduct of defense counsel. He rejected five takes. The court describes his availability as extremely limited. The court wouldn't have talked about all that if it wasn't relevant to the inquiry. In this case, it's the opposite of Hills. Defense counsel was beyond available, and I think went above and beyond in many respects. And because the district court gave him no notice that he needed to be available on May 1st until about a week before, 10 days before, it wasn't reasonable for the district court, because otherwise defense counsel has to clear an entire month and just and not know when the case is going to go. And that's not reasonable when he's been told in advance, these are the two and only two dates we have available, and he's planned accordingly. If the court doesn't have any other questions, I'd rest on the briefs on the other issues and ask the school whether they came from reverse. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, the case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course, and I thank you, counsel, for your very helpful arguments. And the bailiff may now announce a recess.